Dear Asian Girl, for Asian girls, by Asian girls.
All right. So, hello for new and old listeners. My name is Erin. I use she, her pronouns. I am one of the podcast researchers on the team. And today we have Dahi Lee as our guest. And Dahi is an education advocate, especially working in line with undocumented immigrants in the New York City area. And today we will also be joined by my co-host, Naina, who is a podcast host. But today we will be discussing our country's relationship to undocumented immigrants and education, especially in relation to the COVID-19 pandemic that is ongoing. So today, I think we really want to focus on Dahi. What led you to go into like this line of advocacy?
That's a long answer, but I mean, essentially, like, you know, I'm an immigrant. I come from an immigrant family. Like, I have undocumented family members, and that's kind of how we got started. So regardless of whether I wanted to be a part of this, I was born into it, you know, as an immigrant. Mm-hmm. Like, this is just naturally a part of where I am. But let's see, where should we start? This is such a long story. So yeah, my family's immigrants, and then I initially started off wanting to be a public school teacher, actually, because mm-hmm. I've always cared a lot about students, and I always thought that education was a really great tool for students to get to wherever they need to be and to gain mobility in whatever way they need. And so I did that. I was a school teacher for a while, and I found myself at the ceiling always, where I realized the lack of power I had as a teacher. Like, of course I have all the space that I need and all these things, but even as a school teacher, like, if I noticed a student was struggling, or if I saw that a student needed some extra help or some financial resources or some injustice that was going on in their lives, I as a teacher had so little power, and it was very frustrating. And actually, I had to quit one of my jobs. I used to work at one of the New York City specialized high schools, and I got in trouble because I kept passing students because I didn't want to contribute to the cycle of, if they fail this class, they cannot graduate. If they cannot graduate, they will be stuck in this negative cycle that they're in. And I was like, I will not contribute to this. My personal sense of justice, I guess, came in, and I was confronted at the school, and they're like, you can't do this. And I was like, well, I quit. And so I left. Because I was like, this is not good. This is not right. And I was trying to just look for different avenues of like how I could work with students and young people, but at the same time, foster a sense of justice and bring equity to these students' lives. And so I was like, trying to think, I was like, oh, what does that even look like? And I guess I start to look for it outside of like an institutionalized setting. So like not at school. And I was like, okay, where else are there young people? Where else are the students? And I kind of realized of course, this was when I was in college. And so I was heavily involved with a lot of social justice work and with a lot of activism, specifically in New York City. So I think I just realized one day, like, youth organizer. And I was like, oh, that's a thing? You can do that? And I think I just got really lucky, to be honest, to be at this intersectionality of like youth work and education, but at the same time tying that into organizing and social justice. So that's how I got here, really. That's it.
Yeah. No, it sounds like you found your perfect intersection. So I'm glad you're getting fulfillment out of your job now versus as a teacher. But like you said, education is like a pivotal part of your role in this, whatever youth programs that you're conducting, whatever youth work that you're doing. So that's our goal here today, to just provide more education on this topic. And I would like to open up with now these struggles, or like the experiences of undocumented immigrants, specifically before the pandemic started. You had already briefly mentioned the cycle that happens with specialized high schools, where students will perform bad, and then it's this pipeline of not be able to go to good schools, and then not be able to go to college, and then all these repercussions of losing wages. And then we can get onto that later in this topic, which is just struggles for undocumented immigrants you should be highlighting that were very prevalent, at least before the pandemic.
I think the first thing is that undocumented students and their families don't have basic access to things that they need to thrive in this country. For example, health insurance. Like, if a lot of undocumented immigrants don't have health insurance because they don't have a social security number, which is something you need to get health insurance. So you're just left without a safety net of like, what happens if I get sick? So that's one thing. And another thing is the lack of federal relief and aid. Like, aside from the COVID stuff, only 12 states, or 11 now because Wisconsin pulled out, offer federal financial aid options to, well, not even federal. There are 12 states that offer statewide financial aid for undocumented students. Well, of course, they don't say undocumented. They say regardless of immigration status. But that's, you know, 11 out of 50 is nothing. And so there's a lack of access to funding higher education, which, of course, leads a lot of undocumented students and a lot of undocumented people outside of the pursuit of higher education, thus excluding them from, like, higher work opportunities and all of these things. And I think a big thing that a lot of people still overlook in terms of undocumented people is the stigma around it. At least, for example, like in a lot of Asian communities, specifically in my experience in the Korean American community, it's still very shameful to be considered undocumented. And a lot of people are still very hush-hush about it. And so I think the shame really has a lot of impact on people, and especially on students, because as students, a lot of the times, especially in Asian American communities, like, you often feel the pressure to, like, succeed for your family. Like, they've worked so hard, and, like, you feel the pressure to succeed. And I think being undocumented adds on to that, because it's like, I have to succeed, but I'm undocumented. I can't have these things. Oh my God, this is hard. In addition to that, like, the isolation that a lot of undocumented people feel, where, like, because you can't talk about it openly, there's no, like, undocumented hangout space, come here if you're undocumented, like, that's not a thing. So it's really hard for these people to find community, to feel like they're supported. It's especially difficult because when you're in a country that doesn't even validate your existence, how can you expect your peers to do that? This overall narrative of, like, shame is really harmful, and the only narrative that this country paints is, like, you're only valuable to this country if you can work, or if you're going to financially contribute, like the DACA, the Dream Act, that grants you temporary status to live here only if you are pursuing an education or if you're working. While that is great and it gives temporary relief, like, the big message is, unless you can financially give money to us, you're really useless.
Obviously, the pandemic exacerbated so many issues and it has worsened so many things for so many different communities. And particularly, I know it has been hard hitting for these undocumented and low income communities, because they are the frontline first workers, and they're the ones that are first exposed, and they're the ones that are, like, basically, essentially, like, in, like, the eyes of our government, they're not recognized. So they're disposable, basically. I would like to hear your take on how the pandemic has kind of exacerbated and worsened these tensions.
It's definitely made it worse. For example, like, all the stimulus checks, like, all of, like, whatever COVID workers funds things, they're not eligible because they do not have a social security number. And an authorized taxpaying identification number is not enough. You need a social security number. And at least in New York City, like, 28% of undocumented people are living in poverty. And so these are the people that need relief the most, and yet they're completely barred from it, which is completely unjust. And I feel like New York City is, like, a little liberal bubble. So we do have the Excluded Workers Fund, which was an option for people to apply for relief regardless of immigration status. But of course that ended, and that was a one-time thing. So even that is, like, a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. So that's, like, the first thing. Like, these people don't have access to federal relief when they are paying literally billions in taxes. Going off of that, like, undocumented people are the core of our frontline workers. Like, they're the ones doing dishes. They are the nannies. They're the cooks. They're the house cleaners. Like, they're, like, the painters. They're these people that do all of these essential jobs. They're the cashiers at grocery stores. Like, they do all of this essential work, and yet they're so disregarded, disrespected by the government. And it's really a shame to see these people risking their lives to make wages because they have no other way of providing for themselves. And it's really tragic just seeing that cycle happen. And in addition to that, like, they don't get financial relief, they have to work. And when they get COVID, they're pretty much just screwed over because they don't have health insurance. If you go to the hospital, it's like, how are you going to pay your medical bills? How are you going to get the medical attention, whatever that may mean? Everything is so tied into each other because of the social stigma. Like, people are afraid to go get tested. People are afraid to get vaccinated. What if they find out about my immigration status, and then now I'm unsafe. There are so many different aspects of being undocumented that the pandemic just makes worse. You're already dealing with like the psychological impacts of living in perpetual anxiety because of your status. And especially during COVID-19 with like all of the anti-Asian hate, with just the anti-immigrant sentiments and all of that that were coming up, it's really added to the psychological stress of these undocumented people. And it's further stigmatized like a person's status, and especially in the Asian American community where it's already so shameful. Like all of the anti-Asian hate stuff just made it exponentially worse. Because per se, if you are undocumented, if you're a victim of a hate crime, those people aren't going to feel safe reporting that crime because they're undocumented. And so they don't know whether they can trust the police, whether they can trust authorities. So it really, undocumented people really are the most vulnerable, marginalized people during the pandemic, in my opinion.
If I'm not wrong, I think Asians, the Asian communities are the one that are doing the least reporting, whether it's in regards to sexual harassment, physical harassment, any of those cases, because of the fear and this paranoia of like upsetting the balance of your already so precarious life. And you were mentioning a lot how our country is very used to taking advantage of these undocumented immigrant communities as the friendly workers. And even though they comprise a majority of all the roles in our society that are even deemed like lowly or like untouchable, I feel like that's contributing a lot to our stigma of not wanting to associate with them. Because you also mentioned how like people, when also discussing immigrants, they always share the narratives of these successful, financially stable, undocumented immigrants, when in reality, that's such a hard thing to accomplish because of the barriers that we put up for them. So in general, there's a lot of this inferiority that is created around these communities. So I would like to discuss specifically that and how that manifests in these psychological effects, and how maybe you've seen perhaps your own family relatives who were dealing with that psychological stress and that psychological imbalance that comes from feeling so inferior in society.
It's that inferiority is definitely real, because it's like, not only are you shamed by like the government, not only are you shamed by people that aren't of your ethnic background, but you're shamed by your own community. And that really hits hard, you know, because it's like, again, this the only narrative that's painted of immigrants is the hardworking immigrant who's really pulled themselves up by the bootstraps, and they're just thriving and succeeding. And if they can do it, you can do it, and you have no excuse. And like, that's a very painful, harmful narrative to paint, especially considering how hard it is for a lot of immigrants to have access to the things that will gain them social mobility. Like, for example, in my family, my cousins were undocumented, and they came over in like 1990 something, and for a long time my cousin in high school really felt unmotivated to graduate high school, because he thought, I can't pay for college. What's the point of graduating high school if I'm just gonna not have an opportunity to do anything? And even when he went to college, to be honest, he dropped out of college too, because he was like, I don't have work authority, I can't work, what am I gonna do? And so like, it's very demoralizing to, at least for my cousin, it was very demoralizing to have to constantly deal with the reality of like, even if I work hard, there's still the ceiling that I'll never pass, because I don't have the protection and the authority of a citizen in this country. And so that really was harmful, because it's not like my cousin was lazy. It's not like he didn't want to. It's literally so demobilizing, and it's like demoralizing to know that something completely out of your control is preventing you from succeeding in this country.
No, most definitely. It's so insidious, conquer and like divide tactics that our government kind of employs, because that just makes everything so much more difficult, when in fact the real enemy is like the government itself. But yeah, no, in the same vein of education, because something that definitely has also been a sort of driving demotivation factor as well is this transition to remote learning. And I know particularly for a lot of low-income undocumented immigrants, the access to having like the technology is just, it's not there. It's very much lacking. And I know you work as well like on like educational advocacy. Are there vignettes or like stories that like you can point out or pull out just kind of further highlight this issue?
Mm-hmm. I think remote learning has really, it's such a double-edged sword because like, yeah, while it allows students to be at home and safe from COVID, schools are not providing the necessary resources for students to learn remotely. Like, for example, I have an undocumented student and they had a really hard time going to school remotely because they didn't have a laptop and they only had like a cell phone. So they were literally zooming into class on their iPhone. Like, how can you possibly learn when you're on your couch with like your four siblings screaming around you, live in a two bedroom, and you're on your iPhone? Like, how much could you possibly learn? These students are already so disadvantaged because they don't have access to like the funds or the resources necessary for educational mobility, and remote learning just like tanks that. Like, I think the least a school can do is provide devices. Like, the least they can do is provide a device for each student, because you can't, schools cannot leave it wholly up to the family to be able to provide a space to learn stable Wi-Fi and a device. Like, it's very unrealistic for schools to be doing that. And I don't think people realize how hard remote learning actually is, especially like a lot of adults who aren't in high school. Like, no offense, but remote learning is really hard. You know, like when you're home and you're in your bed and it's warm and you just don't want to pay attention to school. Like, I completely get that. Or like if you live in a small house and like your entire family is just around you all the time, it's really hard for a student to focus on school. Me, for example, I actually graduated during COVID. I had to give my graduation speech on Zoom. It was the most depressing thing on the planet, let me tell you. I actually never finished my senior thesis because I was completely unmotivated to do so. I don't know how I graduated, but I didn't finish it. I was so completely unmotivated to do so because I was at home and my home environment is not the most stable, safe home environment. It's very loud. I have like a sibling to take care of. And here I was like away from all of my classmates, away from my support network. And I was like, there's just no point because it's like, this isn't going to be what I wanted. I don't get the community I want. There's all this stuff going on around me. Like, in addition to that, like, I actually had majority of my students tell me that in the beginning of COVID, like in 2020, initially when everyone remote, teachers actually were kind of nice about it. Initially, they were like, oh, we understand it's hard, so just communicate with us, let us know when you need. But next year, school year comes around, all of a sudden, teachers are ramping up tests, giving out more homework assignments, and being a little less lenient with grading. And I was like, oh, what's this? And I was very confused. And a lot of the students told me that what their teacher said was, oh, you're at home, you have more time, so here's more work. Like, and I was like, what happened to it's COVID, we're grieving. What happened to that empathy? I don't understand. Because I would also think, you know, as a teacher, I would think, I don't want to do more work during COVID. I'm tired too. So it made me wonder, like, do teachers want to do more grading? Do teachers want to look at more papers? I know I, as a teacher, would not want to do that during COVID. I want to curl up in bed and cry. Like, so I was so confused by that. So, and like, imagine like teacher piles on work and all you have is an iPhone and four siblings screaming around you. How can you possibly learn in those circumstances? You literally can't. So back to the point, yeah, undocumented students don't have access to devices a lot of times, don't have access to internet, don't have access to a good learning environment, and yet are expected to meet these expectations that are put upon students that have the privilege to access all these things.
I think a lot of what hurts about the expectations is the fact that, like, especially in like a traditional Asian family where like education is very prioritized, the simple narrative that's like not true at all, like the true, you know, conflicts that arise, the narrative in your head that you want to push to your kids is like, work hard, do all the like, you know, good citizen things, and like it'll just propel you to like the top of, you know, the classes. You're going to be financially stable, you're going to have this like American dream, when in fact that is not the reality. And I think putting that into like kids' heads who are just already so stressed with the pressure of school and whatnot, and the pressure of just trying to change their whole atmosphere and their whole mindset to working at home. I think it's just setting them up for like this heartbreak of thinking there's something wrong with you, when in fact, it's the system that is so rigged. So in addition to that, I know that in New York, I think the mayor declared this new rule where like you are not able to get into a school locally, if I'm right. You're not granted immediate access to a school. You must have this application. So I know this is just one of the many things in New York that are creating the systemic imbalance and gap for a lot of POC that are not as affluent as the white community. So I would like to turn the topic more to New York and their way of going about education. So whether you'd like to start with the law that the mayor had already implemented or just the system in general, I would love to unpack that.
So New York City school systems are very complicated, especially high schools. So New York City is split into 26 school districts. I'm going to fact check myself really quick because this is really important. I'm wrong. It's 32.
32. Okay.
Looking at my own paper, there are 32 school districts. There are 32 school districts. It's one of the biggest schools in the country because there's just the population here is insane. So initially, New York City high schools, how they used to work is like the rest of the country, you just go to school in your neighborhood. That's how it is in most places, which is called a zoned school. There's also the option in New York City to apply for high schools, which means you can apply to go to a high school that's not in your school district. Wow, that sounds cool. Oh, here's the thing, though. So New York City, as of December 20th, got rid of zoned high schools, meaning that in order for you to go to high school in New York City, you have to apply. And if you don't, then you just don't go to high school. And this is a problem because, like, you have to apply to high school. First of all, that's stupid. You can edit that out. That's stupid! Sorry, my internal rage. Anyway, so a lot of the issues with that means a student is not guaranteed a seat at their local high school, which means that they might have to commute far or they have to have the access to a device to apply to a high school. It's also a lot of research that you have to do because there's like a ton of high schools in New York City, and you usually list your top 15 high schools and you submit an application through a citywide application process. Later on, you like find out either you got in, they ask your GPA, they want an interview, or they want to look at your test scores. So it's a really long vetting process and you're not guaranteed a seat at the high school that you want, basically. And so by taking away the zoned high schools, it creates this opportunity gap for students who might not have the capacity to research high schools, who might just want to go to a high school near their house. And it takes this opportunity away, which is very unfair. This is just public school, by the way. There's also this thing in New York City called the specialized high schools. They're public schools, but they're elite public schools in which there's an entrance exam called the specialized high school admissions test. And it's basically this test. It's very much like the SATs in which students have to take the test. You have to get a certain test score to qualify for these schools. The market for study rooms for these tests are crazy. I don't know what it's called in English, but they have these things in Korean called hagwon. It's basically like a learning place or like a tutoring center where you go and they just cram your brain with SAT test stuff. And of course, if you don't have the money to, you know, go aggressively learn, you're not going to do well on the test. So this, of course, already creates an opportunity gap for low-income students of color versus not low-income students of color. And this definitely shows because in 2019, I think 4% of offers to the specialized high school admissions went to Black students and 6.6% went to Hispanic students. And that's like nothing. 51% went to Asian students, actually. So this system really benefits the Asian American community. And because of that, of course, aggressively fitting into that model minority myth. Oh, there's just so much wrong. New York City is very gerrymandered. It's very segregated. And so a lot of those neighborhoods in which there are more low-income people of color versus like white middle-class people, that's going to affect their quality of education.
Are you an avid reader searching for new and insightful literature pieces to dive into? Or an aspiring writer seeking to express what you are most passionate about? Well, Dear Asian Youth Literature has you covered. Follow at Dear Asian Youth Literature on Instagram to explore and be kept updated on the countless literature pieces written by young and rising Asian writers, or become one yourself and find your writing pieces on the Dear Asian Youth Literature account.
Yeah, definitely. And I know just living close by as well, I have friends that live in the city. I actually have two friends that went to Bronx Tech, and then I had others that went to Stuyvesant. Definitely, I know that this problem of education and zoning, that is very prevalent in the neighboring district, Long Island as well, redlining. But something that I know, because I did work with other districts in my area, because the way Long Island works, with education, most people end up going to their public high school. And I remember when I was talking to other students from this neighboring district that was predominantly Black, because my district was definitely predominantly white and definitely middle class. I was talking about like our access to educational opportunities and kind of what was being perpetuated by like school administration and our opportunities for the future. Because at my high school, it was, oh yeah, you're going to college. There was no question. You would be an outlier if like you didn't go to college. But I remember talking to them and they were like, oh yeah, my guidance counselor told me that I should go straight to employment after graduation, or maybe I'd be lucky enough to go to my community college. So definitely one thing that I want to turn the focus to is the psychological effects for like low-income people that are Black, Latinx, and other people of color, all these systems telling you that this is not what you're supposed to do.
I think just the expectation for people of color, especially Black and Hispanic students, are so low. That, of course, when that narrative is consistently pushed upon you, then, of course, you're not going to want more for yourself. For example, there's this high school in New York City called Francis Lewis High School, and it is known as the ROTC school. For those of you that don't know what ROTC is, ROTC is Reserve Officer Training Corps. So it's a program that's basically prepares young people to become like officers in the U.S. military. Very strange. But it's very prevalent in this school, Francis Lewis, Franny Lou, as we call it, high school. And it just so happens that the majority of the students there are immigrant, Asian, Hispanic, low income. So to push this type of program upon these students instead of prepping maybe like college readiness or like other careers that aren't the military, you know? Like, of course, it perpetuates the school to like military pipeline. And for example, if you look at any of the elite high schools, like you see like all of these extracurriculars, like you have Key Club, you have Model UN, you have more AP classes compared to like these low-income public high schools. And it just so happens in New York City, low-income is equivalent to person of color. And so you're basically telling these students of color, don't even bother trying to do anything more. What? This terrible narrative that's painted. And like with students, it's really important for us to foster growth in our students, and not saying that college is the end all be all, but to perpetually give this narrative that, oh, it's not an option for you, is really cruel and is really unjust. And so I think the biggest thing that needs to change is like school administration and teachers need to give options to all students, regardless of whether they want it or not. The option should be there, like AP classes, extracurricular activities, even internships, like, because a lot of these competitive high schools, like students go in and they graduate high school with an internship. And I'm like, you're literally 17. Why do you have an internship on your resume? But nonetheless, it puts them at a social advantage that a lot of these students that go to these non-specialized, non-elite charter / like private schools don't have. And so you need to start bringing these opportunities to these schools, and we need to start like encouraging students that you deserve more.
It would be like a mutually beneficial thing for both the schools and our country, as well as the students, because there have been so many connections to inaccessible education causing these costs to state prisons and welfare systems, for example. And then also just that would reduce unemployment rates, I'm assuming, like all these other benefits would come if we made education less inaccessible. So I would like to ask you, like, if you see any stories of what happens really when like someone is unable to have the education that they're like striving for, like what is the pipeline that like most students are faced with when they're unable to apply to college because they don't have a social security number due to being undocumented or any other conflicts that arise from the inaccessibility?
Well, of course, if you drop out of high school, then you can't go to college. That limits you from being able to achieve higher social mobility as seen in this capitalistic society, which is very unfortunate, but it's the truth of the matter. Like, a college degree, while it is really expensive and doesn't guarantee you a job, it heightens your chances by even the slightest bit, which can mean a lot to some people. And so it's less so about graduating high school, and I think it's more about getting through college. Because a lot of times, these undocumented students, we push to go to college, be like, go to college, get an education, all this fun stuff. And then, like, they go to college. You have to pay out-of-state tuition to go to a community college. And so there's the financial burden of that. So a lot of times, undocumented students often have, or even low-income students, they often have to work in addition to going to college full-time. And that is very stressful. You know, even college itself is stressful to students. Like, imagine working a job, and it's oftentimes, it's not fun jobs, you know, it's like a food job, a retail job, a job that isn't the most fun career enhancing job in the world. And so this affects students' ability to succeed in schools a lot. And a lot of the times, actually, there's been more success proven in a 2-year higher education model as opposed to a 4-year model, which is really interesting because it allows students to get their degree faster, it allows them to less financial stress, and it allows them to get into the workforce quicker. So it's oftentimes when students are going into college, they drop out of college. Either that, or when they're in high school, they don't try to apply to better schools because it's out of their financial range to do so. Especially in Asian American communities, like, families tend to stay pretty close and they don't want you to go to school far away. They want you to be close to your family. And so a lot of undocumented immigrant students, like, often don't have that privileged experience of, like, being fully independent, of, like, knowing what it's like to kind of be on your own, because they often end up going to schools close to their families. And so it's very difficult for students to succeed. And often, of course, if you drop out of college, then you can't get certain jobs. And if you can't get certain jobs, you can't break out of certain social spaces, which allow for more opportunities, like, such as mental health issues, homelessness, like, all of these issues just kind of feed into each other, and all starts, unfortunately, at the amount of education you receive. Like, a lot of people find education as a means of escape. For example, if you live... Oh, no, this is a really great story. I have a student from a long time ago when I used to be an actual real teacher in the system. I had a student who, she had a lot of comfort in me because, you know, I'm a good person and I listen to my students, duh. But a lot of times when she was talking about going to college, she would describe, oh, I can't wait to go to college, can't wait to go to college, la, 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 la. And I was like, oh, very normal. But then as she started opening up to me, she expressed how she lived in a very difficult household. She lived with a single mother and her sister, and her mother was not the best mom. And so she was really looking forward to go to college as a means to get out of her household situation. Because her whole life plan was, I'm going to go to college, I'm going to get a job, I can move out, and I can manage better boundaries with my toxic family. But if you are undocumented, and if you don't have the means to get this type of education and escape, then you're kind of just stuck. And so it's so many vicious cycles. Like, it's like a cycle of poverty, it's a cycle of abuse, it's a cycle of trauma. Like, there's so much that education can help someone get out of. And I think people, like, education is so valuable. And if we value education so much, we should really, you know, do a better job at making it accessible.
Yes. And now I'd like to move forward with, especially with this new Omicron variant, like, remote learning is going to be forced upon a lot of schools and a lot of students who have to now deal with the consequences of people not social distancing, as well as, like, new variants. But point is, I would like to hear from you, like, what should we be seeing from schools in terms of action, whether it's through the idea you had of, like, you know, being sensible and schools giving students the necessary resources, like laptops, if they have the funding for that. Or also talked about in-state tuition, how, like, most states do not allow that for undocumented immigrants when they should qualify for that because they are the ones most financially struggling. So in general, like, what should we see in the future with other variants?
I'm trying so hard not to swear and go off at DOE right now. Like, oh my God, DOE, no offense. I don't, because I listen to your podcast, and you're because, you know, I do, but like, DOE really said F them kids. Am I right? They literally said F them kids. Like, oh my God, I could go off about Omicron. I have, so in my program, I have around 80 students. I think 20 of them have COVID right now. That's alarming. Like, oh my God. And the reasoning is because, oh, this really makes me angry. I'm so sorry. First of all, lenient attendance policy. I had a student who got COVID 2 weeks ago, and she emailed the school saying, hi, I have COVID. I'm not coming in because I have COVID. And the school essentially said, well, you're going to be marked as absent because you're not present today. Apologies. And the student emailed back saying, is there any way I could participate remotely? And the school basically wrote like this long email that was like, well, now that we've completely taken off the hybrid model and we're more in person, it would just be so much easier for you to come. We could isolate you in your own classroom for the whole day. So basically what happened is my student did not go to school because, you know, she is the socially responsible person, but she knows of another student who did go to school, went to school with COVID because they could not take the absences because they need to graduate high school. So this student went to school with the mask on, high school with like 3,000 students in it. And what they did to him was they basically just put him in his own classroom for the whole school day for 8 hours. He was just in his own classroom and they had a nurse like bring him his lunch. Like, this is the stupidest thing. Like, is this really the best our city can do? I'm sorry. I get so frustrated. Like, lenient attendance policies. That's the first thing. You have COVID. Don't do that. Second, like, schools need to provide better resources to these students, like whether that be, you know, mental health counseling, whether that be like free testing or offers for vaccination sites, list of where to get vaccinated, or even for parents, like, because there are a lot of students, like I have a student who could not get vaccinated because their parents were anti-vaxxers. Very unfortunate. And I think something that the schools could do is kind of aid in the process of getting people vaccinated and boosted by providing like a fact sheet, being like, oh, here's some FAQs about the COVID-19 vaccine. Here's some FAQs. Like, that's the least schools can do. Like, lenient attendance, providing information, creating safety around vaccines, and last but not least, like, providing devices, you know, like, give laptops out, give iPads out. Hybrid learning, please. Like, and what really is sinister is how, like, a lot of the private schools in New York City actually have gone remote during winter break. And yet you have these public schools forcing students to come into school with COVID. What is that? It's so unjust and it's so wrong. And I think schools really need to understand that we're in a pandemic. And worst of all, the other day I saw this ad for Eric Adams, the new bootlicking mayor of New York City, who, by the way, the other day, he said that low-skill workers are not equipped to sit at desks and have these entry-level jobs. He said that. I'll pull it up. I'll send it to you guys. But he basically just said that, oh, restaurant workers don't have the skills to work office jobs. And I was like, all right, dude, I can't wait to yell at you. Anyway.
Is it the skills or the opportunities? Let's ask us that for one.
Yeah, like, what, like, you tell me, can you operate a Zoom classroom with 60 people? Like, if you ever worked in food, have you ever had 4 people screaming at you because, like, they don't have their sandwich? Like, deal with it, Eric Adams. Anyway, I can go off on him. But anyway, he made this promotion that was like, our school's positivity rates are low. And, like, the transitioning has been an all-time low. Why do 20 of my 80 students have COVID then? Most of them go to different high schools. If they don't have COVID, like, I know so many students have been exposed, like, it's so ridiculous. And I think schools are, public schools, like, really need to do more to protect students. Because, like, what if you have an immunocompromised family member and you have to go to school? Like, oh my God, it's just a disaster waiting to happen. Like, I understand going fully remote is difficult, but schools need to at least offer a hybrid learning model at the minimum. Like, at least have the option available to students.
Ugh. No, yet. Everything you said. Yes, so true. Because I know as someone working in the food industry, like I have had those four people yelling at me for their sandwich. Like,
my God, like you sit there and you have people call you names and attack your personality because their coffee had like the wrong milk in it, which they can magically taste. Yeah. Like, imagine dealing with that, man. I challenge Eric Adams to do my job for one day. My God.
No, and the fact that it's usually like some white woman.
Literally. Oh my God. I worked at the sandwich shop and this white lady came in. She's like, hi, I'll take this steak and whatever green sandwich. And I was like, oh, sure, ma'am. You know, because I'm nice. She's like, can you take the bread out though? And I was like, what? She's like, can you lettuce wrap it? And I was like, I don't think we have the option to do that. She's like, but you have lettuce. And I was like, unfortunately, ma'am, it's not a menu item, so I can't lettuce wrap it for you. If you'd like, and I was a bad person. Like, if you'd like a salad, we have plenty of salads available for you. Because I was just done. But, or like, someone wants to ask me for the frozen mac and cheese. Like, it's the most ridiculous things. My gosh.
Yeah. No. No. I feel all of that. But just kind of getting, I guess, to like the conclusion sort of. So like based on like all of these discussions, like where do you think like our attention and like our energy should be directed in terms of advocacy?
I think it really should be towards providing, at the base of it, it's immigration reform, right? Because the whole thing is that undocumented people don't have access to basic things like healthcare, financial resources, education, like safety, a home. Like, they don't have access to these basic things like to live and thrive. And so I think it really should be focused on getting a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, because even if you have DACA or even if you have work authority, there's no way for an individual to become a citizen and to gain those things unless they have a family member, unless they get married, or unless like they go through the arduous United States immigration procedure. And that's simply unjust. Like, you're going to be, okay, so you work here and you can pay taxes, but we're not going to, at the end of it, like, you still have to leave. Like, how ridiculous. Like, the most of our advocacy work really has to be focused on immigration reform, and we need to figure out a way to get a pathway to citizenship for these undocumented immigrants. And especially recently with the Build Back Better package, specifically the place where I work at the Minkwon Center, and we are affiliated with this organization called the NACASEC organization, and we've been aggressively fighting to include citizenship and immigration registry into the Build Back Better package. And so I do this twice a week. I call Mr. Chuck Schumer. He hates me now. And I phone dog him every week being like, you need to push for immigration reform. You need to tell Kamala Harris to make this essentially like an executive order providing a pathway to citizenship to immigrants. There's been literally no immigration reform since like Ronald Reagan, and I was not alive then. And it's about time, you know, we provide these people with like the basic things they need to live. Like, migration is a human right. We need to stop punishing people for practicing their right of migration. Like, humans are humans. We move around. Putting these people in jails, putting children in cages is not going to solve the solution. Like, we need to provide these people the safety and the protection that they need, provide a pathway to citizenship, and stop deporting people, period. Fuck ICE. That's all. That's all.
Amen. But yes,
it's true.
I second that with what you're saying. Migration is not, it's a human right. It's not something you earn through climbing the social ladder the way that it would benefit the higher ups and, you know, the economy. It is a basic human right we are born with. So I second that.
Yeah, literally. If you Google image me, I'm sure you'll find there's like a Getty Images thing of me, in front of the building holding like a fuck ICE sign. And I like pray to God my mother to see this, because my mom actually doesn't know what my job is, because she's
oh God.
I'm always so scared. Like, I hope to God my mom does not see that someday.
You still think you're a teacher?
Yeah, she thinks I'm a teacher.
Oh, I mean, a teacher at heart. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't even know how to explain my job to my mom. You know, like when you have immigrant parents, how do you explain community organizing? I don't even know where to start.
How do you explain social justice when their reality is just trying to stay afloat in this country? Like, we're not going to try to advocate for people. That's their mindset. Yeah, but I mean, that's the way society like forces us to be in America. So yeah, I mean, there's so many layers to this conversation, but thank you so much for like discussing this with us. And definitely with this Omicron variant, there's a lot of things we should be seeing, a lot of things that like we at the very least can advocate for and have conversations about. And just, we should really just break loose of that stigma that is so centered around these conversations of undocumented immigrants, because it is not some failure on their part, because it's just a failure in the system. And I think we need to learn how to separate that. So thank you so much for all the information you've given us today. And it's really been enlightening.
Yeah, thank you for holding space. This is a very important conversation.